Hello and a warm welcome to today's episode of Pipe Up the Organ Podcast. I'm delighted to be joined by Charlotte Gardner, the freelance writer, critic and journalist. Charlotte, a very warm welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, David. I'm very happy to be here.
Lovely to have you. My first question really, and it's a general one, is how have you ended up working in music journalism? Is there a path you took? Did you have any particular inspirations along your way, perhaps?
Well, I have a guess, a fairly, if there is such a thing as a typical way to get into music journalism, mine most definitely is not. The music part came from my mum, the journalist part came from my dad, but not because either of them were remotely musical or involved in journalism. I come from this sleepy seaside Somerset town, not a contact in the world, not a musical family. My dad's a computer salesman and my mother was a teacher. But at church, as so often is the case, you know, a little old lady saw me tinkering on the piano and told my mum, you need to get her lessons. She's musical. And then, so I grew up playing music only in the amateur scene. We never went to any concerts. So it was purely, in fact, my first professional concert that I attended was actually in my first year reading music at Cambridge. So I really did have an amateur music upbringing. And then in my teens, my dad started taking me along to open days at the BBC, because that had been his dream when he was a teenager. He was this working class boy from Neasden, and he was supposed to go and work in a factory. And he had his interview for a factory apprenticeship. He was just about to leave school at 16. But my grandfather was a cleaner at Alexandra Palace when it was the BBC. And my dad dropped him off on his moped for work one day. And my grandfather said, well, do you want to come in and have a nose around before you go? So my dad walked in, and of course, the 1960s, the TV cameras, they looked like Doctor Who Daleks, didn't they? And my dad took one look at these cameras and was like, oh my gosh, I've got to do this. I want to be a cameraman. So he went back to school and said to his teachers, I want to be a cameraman, please. And they looked at him and said, oh, you need A-levels to do that. So he was like, oh, better do A-levels then. And then you do A-levels, he became the first person in his family to go to university. But the trouble was, he did engineering, but working class boys from Neasden then couldn't wait and sit around for the BBC to offer them a job. So he became a computer salesman, but instilled in me just this enthusiasm for broadcasting, this kind of excitement for it. And then when I walked into the BBC for the first time on open days, I was just absolutely hooked as well. So then when I got to university, I was presenting a classical music show on the university radio. I was editing the classical section of Varsity, the university newspaper. And then I got to my third year and I started writing to controllers at Radio 3 and Classic FM saying, can I come and have your advice, please? I'd love to work for you eventually. And they were all fantastic. They all had me in and had a coffee. And then what eventually happened was that Nick Kenyon was the director of the proms at that time. And he got his PA to message me when the BBC put together a sort of a internal database of CVs for people looking for jobs, and a job came up as a broadcast assistant on In Tune on Radio 3, real sort of bottom of the food chain post-production paperwork. So I was invited in for an interview and I got it. But then funnily, that was how I got into broadcasting. But then I ended up 8 years at the BBC. My last 2 years, 3 years were on the Today programme, because politics was always my other thing. But after about 2 years of politics on the Today programme, I realised I was living for the classical music I got to produce. So when my daughter was born, I said, right, I'm not going back. I'll set myself up as a freelance music writer, because I was always struck when I was calling up people to appear on the Today programme, how they'd say, you know, in the arts particularly, they'd say, well, I can talk to you now, I can have the briefing chat, but I'm in the playground. I hope that's all right. There's going to be background noise. And I would sit there thinking, you are so good. I want you to be on the Today programme and you are in the playground. How do I get that? So that's what I did. I stayed at home and I worked my way up in nap times. And ironically, it was the news experience, not the Cambridge music degree, that really got me my first gigs. Because funnily, there's, you know, Cambridge music degrees, Oxford music degrees are sort of, you can't move for hitting them in our industry. Every Tom, Dick and Sally has one. Whereas a music degree plus a news journalism background was a bit more unusual. So it was a very convoluted way in which I got into music print journalism, but I've never looked back. It's really living the dream.
That's fascinating. I mean, just touching on the Cambridge experience, how did you find it? I guess it was quite a theoretical degree, but you know, there's such a performance opportunity or set of performance opportunities there. Perhaps more so out of the degree course. You know, I know you look on the railings at this time of year and you can't move for concert posters. And,
yeah.
And it, you know, someone might be doing Prokofiev, someone might be doing Gilbert and Sullivan. You've got some weird experimental electronic thing going on in someone's basement. How did you find that? There are all kinds of opportunities you could make the most of.
Well, it was a really interesting experience doing music at Cambridge. I mean, for me, it was perfect because I knew even at that point when I enrolled in Freshers Week that I wanted to be a journalist and not a performer. And the Cambridge music course in general, it's very traditional. Some would call it antiquated even. I think it and Oxford, when I enrolled with the matriculated, we were the only people who still had a 3-hour fugue paper. Or was it four? I think it might have been four, actually, wasn't it?
I think it. I confess, when I was a student there as well, but they'd abolished the compulsory fugue paper. I know, I shouldn't say that. You won't talk to me anymore. I think it was four, though. I think
yeah,
it was.
Yeah, I think it was. And, you know, I can remember sitting there on the first fugue lecture of the term and Alexander Gurr saying, look, we're not teaching you how to write fugue so you can write fugues. Nobody can write fugues. Only Bach managed it and kind of Brahms made a good fist of it. We're teaching it to you so that you know how hard it is and that you can't write fugue. And I sat there thinking, well, that's great, but what about my degree? But actually, things like that, the Cambridge syllabus was brilliant because it just gave you this, it taught you everything. So we had that ridiculous 4-hour fugue paper without a piano next to you. You had the figured bass exam. You had an acoustics course where you learned about, you know, the science behind the ear and concert hall acoustics. There was crazy Schenkerian analysis. There was a whole miserable term on Perry's Eurydice, which must be one of the most boring terms ever, but funnily has served me very, very well ever since, getting to know the first ever opera. And it's all these things that have given me huge confidence going forward. And in terms of the performance, yes, you're right. Really, it was only the final year where you could choose to do performance, which for me was fantastic because I wanted an academic degree. And in terms of the performance, I mean, Cambridge is just a fantastic place to be if you are a performer, and there is so much to get involved in. For me, it gave me some of the most profound musical experiences of my life. I'll always remember touring to Notre Dame in Paris, and we rehearsed during the lunch hour. We were singing mass. We rehearsed during the lunch hour when they shut the doors. And, you know, normally before the fire, it was just a throng of people and you were shepherded round and it was like sardines, moving sardines. And for us to be, you know, the only 15 people in that extraordinary space, and the organ scholar gave us turns when everybody was rehearsing, two at a time would walk to the back of the cathedral just to listen to everybody else singing. And my turn came during Ubi Caritas de Ruffli. And I will always remember standing at the back of Notre Dame and hearing Ubi Caritas and being the only person in that space at that point. It was just incredible. And conducting myself, what was Newhall then and Murray Edwards now, taking them on tour to Italy. And just apart from anything else, organising a tour as a shy 20-year-old without the help of any tour organisation and conducting in Milan's Basilica San Ambrogio was just, you're not going to get those experiences anywhere else. So it was wonderful. But the flip side was that in the music faculty, because really even then I was being a journalist and the chapel choirs I was in, the conducting I was doing was really the amateur level stuff. It was the B list. It wasn't the Clare College and the Trinity and, you know, what you were doing as an organ scholar. So I almost, because I was on a slightly different track, I was kind of on the edges of the main university music making. I wasn't in CUMS or CUSO. I was never going to be a soloist in those places. But the interesting thing looking back is that I think I probably should have walked around with a little bit more confidence, because it's interesting since who are the people who are still in the industry now who I remember from my days, and largely it wasn't the most flamboyant characters and the people who were getting the CUSO soloists at the time. But it was kind of the quieter personalities almost, which I always find interesting looking back on. But I mean, it was very happy. And I remember happy conversations around the Pendlebury Music Library photocopier. And I miss that resource, actually, sitting. I've got a little bit of a library behind me in my office, but it's not quite on the level of the Pendlebury or the university library.
You know, I always say to students who are thinking of going to study there that never again will you have that chance to have everything on your doorstep. I know,
yeah,
and I'm not that old, but the internet wasn't such a prevalent force back then. But, you know, thinking about the university library and anyone who's seen it, it's something out of the Addams Family almost, isn't it? You imagine as a great shard of lightning hitting the top of this tower. But, you know, to have all those recordings there and those full scores and those books. And I think, you know, one of the dangers of all this digital material is that you can't walk through those miles of stacks. And, you know, you might be looking for a book on a certain or by a certain author, and next to it, you find something else you'd never heard or you'd never considered. Mm. And I do worry, gosh, this is probably a topic for a podcast in itself, but I do worry as we become so digitally obsessed that that wonderful, you know, and there's that smell, isn't there, in a library? You can't replicate that. You know, you pull a journal out from the 1960s or you might go and pull something out from the 1800s. And there's something wonderful about the real thing in your hands, which you can't. Brilliant as the British Library online might be, there's nothing quite the same, is there? And that you mentioned the Pendlebury, that wonderful smell as you walk into the reading room and you get all those journals surrounding you and the slightly musty fern or you know, dried flowers that have probably been in the corner since 1970.
Yes. But also just the sheer inspiration of being surrounded by other people studying. It's not the same looking up something on your computer at your desk in your own home as it is to rubbing shoulders with other scholars in a library, seeing what book they've just picked up, chatting at the photocopier about the course that they're doing and what they're most excited about at the moment. It's a whole, you are missing experience, but also inspiration by being stuck at home. I think it's one of the things that we've all found, and particularly me as a journalist this past year, it's very difficult to be fed musically, artistically, when you are in the same environment all the time. And not having those random water cooler chats anymore.
I do feel for students who've, you know, essentially lost half of their degree, have in terms of social interaction.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking.
And we, you know, we talk about performance. Think about organ scholars. Think about whatever your discipline. Not to have had that chance for, let's say, the best part of two academic years. That's pretty soul destroying, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I think that the student population, the youngest people have been hardest hit by this. For the students, all of those experiences, at the end of the day, you cannot get back your three undergraduate years. You can make the best of it, you can have a good time afterwards, but yes. And the same thing, I've got two children and they have missed life experiences this year that they're not going to get back. And one of my focuses in my journalistic career, I take a particular interest in young artists. And again, there is this window where you are the right age to apply for competitions beyond young artist schemes. The window where you are young enough to be seen as possibly a bright young thing, as opposed to why haven't they made it by now? It's really precious 2 years that people have lost. And I hope going forwards that our whole industry will be full of grace and curiosity towards this generation who have lost so much and need us to help them get some of it back. And I think that a lot of people have already been really good. The Verbier Festival said that anybody in the Academy last year gets to be on the Academy this year, because of course last year was cancelled. Earlier on in the year I was editing Gramophone's competitions guide, and it was incredibly heartening to see the number of competitions who were saying, okay, anybody who would have been eligible last year, you are still eligible for the next competition instead, or the people who'd qualified last year were just going to do that same competition this year, nobody else is allowed to enter. It's for those people again. And I hope that this is something that we will see more of, and not just for this year, but I think it's going to have to go forwards for the next 5 or so years as we kind of pick up the pieces.
Yeah, fingers crossed. I'm thinking about your journalistic work. Now, we've come in contact through Gramophone magazine. You very kindly, several years ago, when you were doing a festivals feature, asked what we were doing in our Leeds Organ Festival. What's it? Well, I suppose it'd be interesting to see how that festival's features come through the pandemic, really. Have you seen any particularly enterprising responses or entrepreneurial responses to what's been going on?
Most definitely. For starters, people have been very clever. I mean, some people have just been very pragmatic and they said, right, we're just going to move festival. So normally we take place in May. We're going to do it in September this year or the end of August. So if you look at people like Chipping Camden has moved, it's the same starry lineup as usual, but it's not May now, it's September. Fishguard is another. They've shifted from July to August. Investec also, Vale of Glamorgan. So people are being quite savvy. And then there are some really exciting things that people have done with regard to their performance spaces. Longborough Festival Opera has a new circus big top venue that can be indoors or outdoors, depending on what's required. Neville Holt Opera moving outdoors completely. They've constructed an outdoor stage with socially distanced seating. All sorts of things. I mean, North York Moors Chamber Festival, under the direction of Jamie Walton, the cellist, that deserves a mention. They managed to go ahead last year by erecting a whopping marquee, and they're repeating that format this year. And what I particularly like about them is that they have introduced a young artist scheme for 2021, just outlining the fact that young artists really, really need all the help they can get. So this year there will be a selection of young artists coming who will work with established soloists. Really brilliant thing. And then just what it has been very, very noticeable this year is that writing the guide over the past few years, there has been a gradual move to some festivals putting certain aspects of their programming online, digitally streaming it, but not so much so as the competitions world, where they've really been pushing the digital content for years now, because it's the only way to make an international music competition truly feel international and give the young artists the exposure that they need. But that's been much slower with festivals, because I think they're kind of a little bit cozier anyway, and often they're serving their local communities, and I think they haven't seen the need. But of course, suddenly they really have seen the need, and it started last year. Several did actually bring something online as a digital stream last year. But this year, I mean, most people do have live offerings of some sort, which is interesting. We assumed that it was going to be a really wafer thin guide this year, but actually it's the same size as normal, and it could have been larger had I included all of the new festivals and all the ones that I just couldn't quite justify putting in. But this year, the digital streaming is everywhere. And I think for audiences, speaking to the clientele of this particular podcast, this is an absolutely fantastic year to try before you buy. I mean, normally the only way that you can go and see a festival, whether it's in the UK or abroad, is to actually go there. Whereas for the first time this year, if you actually pick up the Gramophone guide, you can zoom in on most festivals, go to their website, and they will tell you what they're streaming. So you can see the venues, you can see the kind of artists they normally have, what the atmosphere tends to be. And you've got a much better idea of knowing whether it's worth booking that weekend away for next year when things are hopefully back to normal.
Do you think there's any turning back? I mean this in a positive way, but now we've all become so much more technically savvy or aware, if we're not savvy. Do you think, say, from 2022 onwards, everyone is going to be offering this digital facet to what they're doing?
Well, I don't really see if you can make it work in terms of your resources and your staff, I don't really see the point in going back, because it brings in more people. And to give you a non-musical example, my church since the beginning was live streaming its services, and by an absolute stroke of goodness, the guy who did the music turned out to have done a degree in television. So very, very quickly, the entire services were online from multi-camera angles, and it was all looking great. And my church is now going, well, we can't stop this now. We've got people tuning in from literally all over the world, as well as all over the UK. It's great for people who can't physically get to a concert. Of course, get to a service. And this is a huge issue as well for reaching enclosed communities with classical music as well. If you are in a prison or an old people's home and you can't get to the performance, suddenly, why would you take that away from people when suddenly wherever you are in the world, as long as you are connected to a computer, you can experience, you know, the service or the music. It doesn't make sense, I don't think. If you've got the resources, the human resources to make it possible, I think that we have to keep going. And I think that going forwards, hopefully accessibility for classical music will really take a rocket skywards as a result of this time, which isn't to say that it's not been a horrific time and we all need to get back to normal. But I think that of all of the things that we can take from this, I think digital, going online and giving classical music to people who normally wouldn't be able to receive it is one of the wonderful bequeathments of this period.
There's got to be a silver lining, hasn't there?
Yeah.
I say to people all the time, say March last year, you'd say to someone, I'll Zoom you. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? And now it's just this. I'm sure it's going to be in the dictionary now, isn't it? To Zoom, I Zoomed, you Zoom, and it's mm-hmm. this as our vocabulary changes and our whole sort of cultural experience. I would like to think, as a journalist, you mentioned Verbi earlier, you must have travelled all over the place. Are there any artists you would, as it were, go above and beyond to hear live?
Yes, so many. Where shall I start? Gosh. The great thing is many of them you can actually hear in the UK. Generally, when I'm travelling, a lot of the time it's for those young artists I want to be able to spot and tell people about in the UK, that because they're not UK artists, we may not be able to see in this country yet. So I will go to a great deal of effort to go to a young artist, a festival where I know there is a really great young artist scheme where I'm guaranteed to see a next big name. Somme Musical de Gstaad in Switzerland in January is one that I'd make a beeline for whenever I can. Then in terms of names that you might have heard of, violinist Janine Jansen, I think that she is one of the most intelligent, sensitive, soulful violinists around. It's all about the music and nothing about the surrounding frippery of the industry with her. There is such integrity to her playing and her programming and everything that she does. I've never been disappointed by her in a concert. And then if you want a UK name, I'm very, very excited about the young British violist Timothy Ridout. The richness, the strength, the depth of his sound. He's an incredible musician. He can get his head around the most complicated new piece of music and make it sound like music when everybody else attempting this piece, perhaps in a competition, makes it sound like a kind of fight between the student and the score.
Test piece, yes.
But I mean, to give you an example of how extraordinary he is and his sound, the first time I heard him in solo recital form was because I had heard him in a chamber formation with the Kronberg Academy at Wigmore Hall. And I turned up and he wasn't playing solo at any point. But when I first heard him play just, you know, a solo line in a trio or quartet or whatever it was, I immediately thought, oh my gosh, who is that? And I was flicking in my program to try and find who he was. And it was based on hearing him in chamber formation and just having a hunch. I traveled all the way to Switzerland when he was doing a solo recital at Somme Musical de Gstaad. And I heard him there. And that performance, literally the first note, I sat there going, yes, yes, I was right. Oh my gosh, wow. And then afterwards, Renaud Capuçon, the violinist, is the artistic director of that festival. And after the concert, he rushed up towards me in the church pew and said, oh my gosh, Timothy Ridout, I haven't heard a sound like that since Gerard Cosé. You must be so happy he's British. So that is Timothy Ridout. So listeners, if you haven't yet gone and heard Timothy, just literally that is the ticket you beg, borrow or steal to get at the moment. Get him while he's still here and he hasn't been snapped off all over the world. And then Ellen Chan, I think is an absolutely fantastic conductor. This is principal guest conductor of the Royal Scottish National, chief conductor of the Antwerp Symphony Orchestra. Now, on one of my travels just before COVID to Zermatt, the Zermatt Festival and Academy, the teaching there for the Academy part is run by the Scharoun Ensemble, which is a chamber subset of the Berlin Philharmonic. And I was chatting to one of the Berlin Philharmonic musicians there, and I said to him, and he was hired by Herbert von Karajan in 1978, so he'd really been around the block, still has been around the block. And I said to him, just out of interest, what do you want from a conductor? And he said, I just want to know when to come in. And, you know, I don't necessarily need to know, you know, this big artistic vision. Literally, what I need to know from a conductor is what they want me to be doing. And when I saw Elim Chan on the podium for the first time, what immediately struck me was the fact that even sitting in the orchestra, I knew exactly what she wanted. Sorry, me sitting in the audience, I knew exactly what she wanted from the orchestra. She was so clear. And she also had a vision, and the orchestra were clearly soaking her up, and she was taking the orchestra with her on her journey, which I think is not everybody has that. And so she's another person I would make a beeline for. I could keep going here. How many more do you want?
Well, that's you know, I was going to say, you're talking about a conductor. You might have done the same as I have here, but I've lost hours of my life watching Carlos Kleiber on YouTube. And you're talking about that with the conductor and just expressing their intention. One thing that fascinates me about his conducting is you could turn the sound off. And I remember watching the overture to Carmen. And, you know, you don't need to hear a note of it. Watching the gesture, you've got every idea of what's going on, or even him doing a Strauss waltz, which you might think is kind of facile music, but something is brought to it. And I think hearing you say that about that conductor just giving such a clear lead, Bernhard Haitink, you know, even in his very close to pre-retirement, that energy you can just see in concentration. It's fascinating to be able to channel that, I think.
It is, and not all the great conductors have it. I'm now thinking of, I'm not going to name names because it would be cruel, but let me just say, a very eminent conductor, very loved, was doing a concert, and I was looking at him thinking, well, I have no idea what you want. I have no idea when people are supposed to come in or everything. And the funny thing was, near they had the orchestra quite clearly. They all clearly absolutely adored this guy. And so that was where the sort of the joy and the frisson of the concert came from. But I mean, even the end note, I mean, it was all over the shop. But it was one of those joyous concerts where, you know, the room is just full of love and you don't care. But I just can't imagine that anybody younger generation would even get away with what he got away with that evening on the podium.
I remember a story. Again, one of my, I won't name, but one of my sort of organ heroes who also conducts was trying to bring some violins in. I think it might have been a Bach cantata, and it was just so unclear. Nothing was happening, and he just said to them, "Well, you just start, and I'll join you in bar three." And they loved, and he was, I mean, such a brilliant musician, and they loved him so much. They said, "Oh, it's just fine. We'll get on with it." And I think when you see these martinet conductors who are trying to micromanage and something goes wrong, I think no one quite has that sort of sense of, I suppose, kindness to actually say, no, just you get on with it, we'll be fine. If the more of a taskmaster you are, perhaps they're less likely to. I'm talking about heroes now, and I have, despite popular belief, I do a little bit of prep before these podcasts, and I noticed on your biography, you did an app with Stephen Huff, is that right?
I did. Stephen did an app with Touch Press on Liszt's B minor piano sonata. Now, these touch press apps are a thing of beauty. It's this wonderfully recorded filmed performance of him. It's a video performance. And as he plays it, the score rolls along underneath so you can follow it. And I wrote the book section of the app. So a biography of Liszt, structure and analysis of the sonata, sort of the impact, its legacy, a history of sonata form, literally everything about the sonata and the surrounding context of it. And Stephen, because I was mostly writing, we only coincided for one day, but it was when he came in to record the artist commentary. So you know when you get the director's cut DVDs of a famous film and you
can watch
the film with the director over the top? Well, we did this with Stephen talking about the Liszt, and it was fascinating stuff. So he just sat down at the microphone and it was everything from, oh, do you know what? I like it when this bar's over. This one is an absolute pig of a bar to play. Or this is the bit in my score where I had to staple bits in because the page turn is awkward, and all of that. But the thing was that he did it in one take. I mean, this is what, a 20-minute sonata, something like, no, it's more than that, isn't it? I can't remember now. But it's a long take. And we just imagined that he would come in and we'd have to do a few versions until he got it right and there would have to be some editing. But no, he sat there and his mind is just so sharp. And he's this wonderful mixture of razor sharp intellect and relaxed as a person. And he just sat there and he did it in a single take. And it was fascinating and articulate. I got to the end of that and we all just laughed. Because, well, there's nothing more to say. Bye. You can go now.
Isn't that, and have you read his book, Rough Ideas?
No, but I want to.
It's great. I haven't quite got to the end of it. It used to, when I was going on the train more, I have a chapter or two, and they vary. Some of them are sort of 3-page diary notes, and some of them are much more involved, you know, talking about the recording process. Mm. But it just strikes me, obviously we know he's a brilliant performer, but the insight and also humility. And there was a whole chapter about, you know, practicing and how he's found that certain things work, some things don't. Mm. And I absolutely love to meet him, but hearing about all the things he can do, he's an artist, isn't he? I think he might have written novels as well. He's certainly written about religion as a Catholic. He just seems to be the sort of 21st century embodiment of the Renaissance man or the polymath.
The polymath,
really can do everything. And he composes, doesn't he? You know, there are all kinds of sonatas he's written and Sound of Music transcriptions. There seems to be nothing he can't really turn his hands to.
Well, yeah, this is it. And I think you've also hit on it with his humility. He's somebody who gets alongside everybody. He never thinks he's got all the answers. But the funny thing is, he generally does, because he's just that good. But he's a wonderful person to work with. I've podcasted with him as well, and he just gets alongside everybody. I thought that his Wigmore concert, when the first post-lockdown Wigmore concert, it was him. It was so moving. I cried, actually. But he was just the perfect person to embody what we had lost and what we were getting back, and the perfect personality to bring in that space and offer a gift to the public. It couldn't have been better programmed, I think, having him as our first one.
No, he's just brilliant, just brilliant. And I've also noticed on your bio, I guess the other end of the spectrum, that you've written some notes for children in concerts as well. How is, when you're doing your list on one day and writing, to explain music and make it more approachable, how do you approach that? Quite a different hat on, I suppose.
Well, yes and no. I absolutely love writing for children because it forces you to really be intellectually on top of what you're writing. There's no space for whiffling around the subject. You've got to be able to encapsulate it in an easily digestible nutshell. And a lot of what's interesting now is that a lot of orchestras, they're not so much doing children's notes, they're doing access notes that will be accessible to everybody. So it's this strange balance that you have to make of writing something that an intelligent 10-year-old and a curious 50-year-old will still get something out of and not feel talked down to or gone over their head with. And I think it's a really interesting intellectual exercise to try to work out what is ultimately a piece all about. How do you articulate that in the most direct way?
I'd not thought about that, but it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? If you can explain it to, I suppose, not to patronise children, really, and take their views and their opinions as being absolutely as equal as, you say, a 50-year-old might be. Does it take longer to write those? Do you find you have to take a slightly different angle to start with, or is it, you know, a similar piece of work?
It doesn't take longer, it's just a different way of doing things. So the time spent with a large through written program note for an adult audience, it's all about crafting a through written piece, and that takes time. You have to, with both things, you're essentially having to, you do all of your research and you put your personal grasp of the musical and wider historical context, and then as a journalist you basically decide, well, what is the story that I'm going to tell? And that's the same when you're doing whether you're doing children notes or adult notes, but with the adult notes you're crafting a through written piece, whereas with children it's often bullet points, so it's equal amounts of work, it's just very, very different things.
What a great thing to do. Oh, that's wonderful.
I think everyone should write children's notes if they can.
Yeah. Challenge to keep them sharp.
Totally, yeah.
I realise I've been talking for quite some time and I haven't yet mentioned the organ, which some might say is a good thing. But as we're an organ festival podcast, I know you're primarily, I guess, focusing on strings in your work with gramophone and Strad, but have you heard any organ recordings or been to any organ concerts recently that, you might be able to tell us about? I shan't be offended if not, but I thought I ought to ask.
No, well, you're in luck, actually, because I had a wonderful year. Of 2019 was just a golden year of travel for me before everything hit. And one of the trips that I did was to the Hamburg International Festival, and the journalists were given this wonderful private recital in St. Jacobi Church, Hamburg, on the Schnittger organ. It was cantor and organist Gerhard Löffler who was doing the recital. Now, this is an I'm quite sure everybody listening is going to know all of these stats anyway, but this is an organ that was built between 1689 and 1693. Largest organ in existence before 1700, one of the most eminent Baroque instruments. And not much has changed, actually, with it between then and now. It's got 40 manuals, a pedal with 60 stops, 15 reeds, about 4,000 sounding pipes, and the old pipe work, some of the pipes are from the original 1516 organ. And sitting in this gorgeous, very Lutheran church decor, it's all whitewashed ceiling, which is just punctuated by these wonderful little red brick lines. It's just stunning. And sitting there in an almost quiet church and listening to this organ that Bach knew about. Bach actually applied for a job at that church, didn't get it. But even Bach knew this organ, knew that it was the thing. And to be sitting in the church and hearing all of that history, it was a very similar experience to when I'm holding a Guarneri or a Strad built around the same kind of time, slightly later. Of course, string instruments do go back to the 1600s. And it's that similar, just being in the presence of history and wondering what stories those instruments could tell. And then in terms of recordings, there's one album I keep returning to. It's sort of my favourite organ album, which is, it's on the Delphian label, The Complete Organ Voluntaries of William Russell, played by John Kitchen on the organ of St James's Church, Bermondsey. It's a restored 1829 organ. And it's just, it's a really lovely programme. It was just written at the point where there was a lot of Handel heritage, but things were just tipping over into the early Romantic period. He was a contemporary of Samuel Wesley. And I really, that I would say is the album that got me into listening to organ music. And I still don't do it an awful lot, but that album really struck me. And then just to give you one more, a recent album, Olivier Latry's Bark to the Future.
Oh, it's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you seen the video?
Great. No.
Oh, watch the, yeah, well, there's a, it's a bit like his take on Bohemian Rhapsody, I suppose, in terms of lights and cameras. I mean, it's poignant because I think it was done just before the Notre Dame fire.
Yeah.
But he's recorded the famous Toccata and Fugue in D minor of Bach. And he's doing it in a leather jacket. He looks a little bit like John Travolta out of Greece. And they've absolutely gone to town on the lighting in there. And, you know, the organ is lit in Technicolor. And he plays it in a very what we might say romantic way. But actually, you're talking about Notre Dame earlier. You know, I think one of the largest, if not the largest, organ in France. You kind of it would be remiss of him not to make the most of what his fingertips. And it's amazing. So if you get a chance to watch that,
I will.
It's very, very clever. I mean, he's such a good organist. You know, one of the greats. Absolutely. One of the greats.
Yeah, he is. And the lovely thing about that recording is, for me, I mean, you're absolutely right. He recorded it shortly before the fire. And the engineering has given it a really strong sense of place. And so that's another reason why I love it so much. I listened to that album and I'm back in Notre Dame.
It just has the sense of that building and such a technique as well. What I would love to ask you, Charlotte, and just before we went on air, as it were, I was asking, you know, is there a inequality or lack of equality in terms of male and female music critics? And obviously the organ world, it is sadly still heavily weighted towards men playing. But I guess taking that and also thinking about what advice you might give, for example, a girl in GCC year who's thinking about following in your footsteps, indeed a boy as well, but what could you say to someone who's fascinated by the music profession and journalism and really wanted to follow the route you've taken?
Well, in terms of equality and music critics, certainly there are fewer female music critics than there are male critics. But in my view, it's not because of equality. It's because for some reason, fewer women want to be music critics. Now, I'm not entirely sure why this should be, but certainly I have a job persuading people that this is a career that is worth going for. I don't know whether there's something to do with it. It is scary earning your living through having a very public opinion on something. And I don't know, perhaps that's something that fewer women feel initially as comfortable with as men. I have no idea. But we do need more women. We bring something very different to it. And I would encourage everybody to go for it. I am literally living the dream. This is a career where you travel the world, where you get to be inspired intellectually, artistically all the time. You meet incredible people. You have wonderful experiences. And every day is different. I have no 2 days the same. If I look just at this week, you know, I'm presenting an interview for Medici TV on Friday. I'm just going to be doing some program notes and a CD review today. Every single day is different. Tomorrow I'll be transcribing an interview with Sol Gobetta and Patricia Kopaczynska for The Strad. If you want a riotous career that literally just makes your heart sing every day and make you want to run to your computer in the morning, then this is the job. Now, the other thing that's worth saying up top is that you don't need to start out with contacts in order to win a place with music journalism. I think it's one of those careers that people assume that it's for people who already have all the connections, and it's not. And I say that as somebody who grew up in the middle of nowhere with parents who could not help with connections. It was all down to me. Plenty of people do have contacts, but certainly I didn't. But you do need to make contacts. Music journalism is both very competitive and with plenty of space for new talent to be welcomed in. So if you want to, then providing you make an effort, you can. Write to people in the industry. If you're really interested, write to people at the top and just say, can I come and have a cup of coffee with you? Not for a job, but for advice. And if they're impressed with you, then you've just earned yourself a contact who will think of you when something does come up. And ideally, they'll also give you your next contact to go and have a coffee with as well. And that's what I did. That's how you start. It's literally impressing people and making those early contacts. Also, work experience. Don't get to your third year of university and then go, whoa, I think I will have a job in music journalism. You've got to do something before that. I worked for free at BBC Bristol in my holidays. I was filling my CV at Cambridge with every single bit of broadcast and print journalism I could get my hands on. And that's really important as well. With writing, there is only one way to become good at writing, and that's by doing it a lot. Write something, send it to an editor and say, look, can I just have your advice? That's what I did when I had decided that I was switching from broadcasting to music journalism. I had been booking the editors of Gramophone and BBC Music Magazine to come on today. So I wrote a couple of CD reviews and sent them to them and said, look, do you think it's got legs? What do I need to do differently? And they were great. They both gave me really valuable advice and I kept on doing it. And be proactive as well. When you are being a writer, it's extraordinary how few people there are who file good copy on time. Now, if editors are always going to love somebody who doesn't just say, can I have some work, but comes to them with an idea, say, OK, this is my story. These are the people I would interview for it. I can supply it for you. Would you like it? And then when they say, OK, I'd like X number of words by this date, please. If you then supply exactly what they have asked for, written really well, then you'll get a second commission. It's just the way it is, because those people are rarer than you might think.
We always want to work with dependable people, don't we? And I think yeah. You said it, going with an idea. I have no idea really about how an editor, what they have to do in their day. But if someone comes and says, look, this is my idea, this is how I'm going to make it work. I mean, surely that is a wonderful thing to have.
Absolutely. I mean, my breakthrough piece, if you like, when I had just left the Today programme, I was sitting at a wedding next to a head of music who turned out to be Damon Albarn's former teacher, Damon Albarn of Blur fame. And we were just chatting and he said, of course, it's absolutely ridiculous. You can get an A at music GCSE and A level without being able to read a note of Western staff notation. And I almost fell off my chair and said, you cannot be serious, really? And he said, oh, yes, yes. So I pitched it as an idea to BBC Music Magazine. I said, did you know? And they said, goodness, no, we didn't. So I did an investigation into music standards in GCSE and A-level. And I got back in touch with this teacher. He put me in touch with Damon Albarn. So I got Damon Albarn as an interviewee as well. And basically, when this broke, we owned the front page of the Times, all the broadsheets covered it that day. BBC News covered it. And that was in. I was in as a journalist. I had put BBC Music Magazine on the front page of the Times that day. And it was literally because I sat next to somebody at a wedding and got into an interesting conversation, went to the editor and said, I think this is a story, and then supplied.
Well, as Top Gear used to say, on that bombshell, I can't top on anything like that. Charlotte, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you and to hear about your travels and how you got into this. And I do hope any young people listening to this will take it seriously, because, you know, it really touched me when you said, you know, no 2 days are the same, and that joy of turning on the computer. I'm sure many people over the last 18 months, for various reasons, couldn't stand turning on their computer. So, you know, to have that sense of excitement every time, a variety, is just wonderful. And it's been such a nice opportunity to talk to you.
And actually, could I just say one final thing about the job itself, in that we need music journalists, we need good music journalists and critics. And as a music critic, you are somebody who has a tremendous amount of sway in the industry. And I can tell you that there is no bigger buzz in the world than being that person who has gone and heard a young artist in one country and then given them the push that they needed to get taken on by a young artist scheme, and you watch their career take off afterwards. There is nothing better in terms of watching how your words can make somebody, some young artist's career grow. I mean, it's irreplaceable. It's very, very special. So do it to change lives as well. Do it to change lives for the better.
Oh, thank you. That's brilliant to hear. Brilliant to hear. Well, this is our penultimate edition. So sadly, we've only got one left. On the 9th of July, I'm joined by Pam Hume, who's now based in Berlin, but has really made a name for herself working with organ and electronics, and thinking about our first podcast with Hume Organ, chatting about a similar style of composition. We're going to hear how Pam uses live looping, so she manipulates the sounds as she goes. And she quite recently completed a master's in research on that. We're going to hear about the work she's been doing in this country, but also in Berlin. So that's our final episode on Friday, the 9th of July. So thanks again to Charlotte Gardner. Thank you for listening. Take care, and join us again in 2 weeks' time for our very final episode. Thanks then. Goodbye.